I was suggesting when we began, the opening statement is interesting in terms of it. It talks about protecting us through the darkness of night. I want to read it to you in an amplified way and then discuss it a little bit, because I may have given the impression of more than is actually in the text. It says, "He who dwells, inhabits, and lives restored, he who camps out after being renewed in the marriage covenant, in the sheltered covering, within the protected place, which is carefully concealed from sight, a safe harbor and sanctuary of the Eliom, the Almighty, so as to be withdrawn, ascending to meet the light, while gaining status and splendor, in the shadow and resulting image, in the likeness and resemblance, as a result of hovering over and being submerged in the protection, the successful empowerment, and the prosperity of the most extensive and powerful Mighty One, the most expansive, capable, and influential One. With the ability to cultivate and nourish and bless life, he will continually abide, dwelling for an extended period of time, remaining during the night. He will lodge and live on an ongoing basis, therefore endure through the time of darkness." Now, the impression that I may have given wasn't designed to do anything more than to be completely open to what God is saying and to being reluctant to set limits. In other words, not being dogmatic. Mm-hmm. And so what I said is, you know, there's a possibility, if you were just to read this by itself, that he's going to protect us through the time of darkness. Well, the ultimate time of darkness is the tribulation. Maybe that's what he's saying here, and that we're going to stay through the tribulation as lights in a dark world. Now,
or part of the tribulation.
So, and then you can say, okay, well, the tribulation has parts. There's the, you know, initial part prior to the Magog War. Then there's the midterm. And then the second half. The second half is the worst part of it. And during the second half, we would be of absolutely no value, because by the second half, you either take the mark of the beast or you reject it. And if you take the mark of the beast, there's no resolution.
No hope whatsoever.
Yeah, no hope whatsoever.
Then they'll kill you the other way. So.
Right. So I was at least open to the idea that through the time of darkness, that could be speaking of the tribulation. But, you know, realistically, what God is talking about is protecting us right now. This is the time of darkness. Mm-hmm. Now, when through the prophet Isaiah was said, you know, for periods of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, he looked for someone that he could work through, someone that he could communicate through. He couldn't find anyone. Mm-hmm. I would call that a time of darkness. I would say that the world has been living in a time of darkness really since the time...
Warfare of the garden.
Yeah, well, to some degree, from the time we walked out of the garden to the time that the light returns in year 6,000, yeah, you could say that. And most certainly would be able to say that from the last of the prophets in about 500 BCE through this... time. I mean, I think it's all a time of darkness. And so I think that is primarily what he's saying. As it relates to the harvest that we know of that is called Teruah and its ultimate fulfillment, I suspect that the best indicator of that is actually Yeshaya 17, where God is talking about this approach to the last days and how things fall into place. And he begins by saying that Syria, greater Syria, is going to fall to the terrorists. And then he says Damascus itself will become a heap of ruins, a twisted heap of ruins. So we should have expected this war that we're witnessing in Syria. We should have expected the success of the jihadists there, if you want to call success what they have done. We should expect that Assad would remain in power for a while, because you know, we're still, you know, 2026 is the fall of 2026 is really the start of the 7-year tribulation. So we should expect should have expected Russia to come in and prop up the Assad regime, because he'd already been gone had they not done so.
Oh, absolutely.
But ultimately, we should expect that, and for certain, that Damascus is going to fall. Then after that, we're told that Israel will be thinned at the waist, which means that the world is going to compel Israel to give up the West Bank. It's already given up Gaza, which will make it about 15 to 20 miles wide at its thinnest point, where 70% of the population live. And we know
in the works. I mean,
that's in the works. That's what the Obamanator wants to do. It's what George Bush before him wanted to do. It's what the UN wants to do. It's whatever Islamic nation wants to do as a first step. And what will happen is the same thing as when the world played this game the last time. Neville Chamberlain sacrificed the high ground of Czechoslovakia to Adolf Hitler, and within 6 months the world was engaged in World War II. The moment that Israel is thinned at the waist, Yahweh has already said that Muslims by the millions, perhaps by the hundreds of millions, are going to flood into Israel as jihadists. Now, between the time that Israel is thinned at the waist and the time that Muslims stream into Israel by the tens of millions, if not the hundreds of millions, we're told that there will be a harvest. That's the Teruah harvest. So it's sometime between those two events. And, you know, we have, and I don't know if it is Christian eschatology that has caused this to be our perception, but when, you know, Daniel doesn't just predict the rise and fall of nations, including the Roman Empire and the nation, the entity that, the beast, if you will, that rises out of Imperial Rome, which is the Roman Catholic Church, treading upon the whole world. He not only provides the exact timing that Yosha would walk into Jerusalem to be cut down, but not for himself, predicting that it was going to occur 4 days before Passover in year 4000 Yah, 33 CE. He also speaks of the seven-year period that we know of as the time of Jacob's troubles, the tribulation. And talks about that the Torahless one is, and he's not the Antichrist, he's the Torahless one.
Mm-hmm.
The Torahless one is going to come onto the scene and the event that's going to kind of launch his status, his fame, is going to be that he's going to somehow be associated with this peace treaty, this reaffirmation, is probably of UN 242,
mm-hmm.
that's going to sacrifice the West Bank to the Muslims. But what we do not know is whether or not that affirmation takes place in 2025, 2024, 2023, 2026, 2027. We've had this in our mind that somehow the affirmation is tied to the first day of the tribulation, but there's no reason for us to come to that conclusion. In other words, we could still be harvested on Teruah in the fall of 2026, after the affirmation of this treaty that ends Israel at the waist, before the Muslims flood into Israel in the Magog War. And
well,
be gone, and be gone on the Teruah in between. Gone before the tribulation begins, but after the peace treaty is formed and before the Muslims attack Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So I still lean towards 2026, but you know it could be 2027. I don't think we can say for certain that the peace treaty that ends Israel at the waist is day one of the tribulation.
No. But it would have to happen before the Magog War.
Yes, it happens before the Magog War.
Third of the world.
Well, the second phase of that war. Right. There are, I think there's three phases of the war. One is where Muslims, by the gazillions, flood into Israel. And, stops them, and that there's going to be a huge death toll as a result of that. And then there's going to be a enormous death toll that will be that the wars that will be promoted around the world in concert with that are, is going to lead to the deaths of lots of people. There is the most likely going to be in the second phase of it a nuclear exchange. And then ultimately, there is the striking of an asteroid and the Apophis and also the Carneviejo, the old volcano sliding into the sea, creating a tsunami effect across the Atlantic. All those things are going to happen, and collectively, first a quarter of the Earth's population and a third of what remains, so half overall of the Earth's population, is no more by the midpoint of the tribulation. So anyway, those are my thoughts on timing. But that said, you know, the Revelation comment is that we'll be kept out of the Great Tribulation. Now that could mean we're kept out of the last 3.5 years. That could be means we're kept out of the entire period, and it also means that, you know, this is spoken in Hebrew, recorded by religious people in Greek. And then you know, and you're
twisted.
Twisted, and you know, we know that there are more differences, more discrepancies between the various Greek texts than there are words in the text. So you know, you're always have to be very careful when you're taking anything from the Greek.
Let me along those lines. Let me ask you a question that might be relevant as we move forward in 91. But currently, I was asked to by a friend of ours to translate a little something, one little passage, one psalm. And so I went to the Dead Sea Scroll Bible, and I find out that every word in there, save one, is extant. And so everything comes from the Masoretic. So I go through all the Masoretic things, and those are so heavily saturated with words where they translate them as to worship and bow down and on and on and on. And you might have 20 meanings that are negative and one where it means respect and you know, that sort of thing. So I'm making note of all that stuff. And gosh, it's hard when they've really decided. Now, this is a thing, which I believe it is, of Dode. A Psalm of Dode.
It is.
And nowhere in the 119th Psalm that I've got Dode saying bow down.
No.
And things like that. So, I mean, so I reject those, and I can't prove it in the sense of overwhelming evidence, but it's so logical that this is not right. These are clerics who are paid.
Right.
You know, they've twisted for their religious purposes. And so I have to go with that. So, I mean, and so when I do that, I have a little trepidation because I worry about, oh, gosh, I hope I'm not really taking too many liberties. But I don't know how else to get through these.
Yeah,
when they're so blatant.
One of the challenges is with the 91st Psalm is the most heavily edited passage that I have yet encountered. And there are whole sections of it that are different in the Dead Sea Scrolls than they are in the Masoretic text. Now, part of the challenge here is that you have to recognize that the Masoretic text specifically edited things that were in disagreement with Rabbinic Judaism. The Masoretic text came to exist around 1100 CE. And so by that time, the codicils of Rabbinic Judaism were pretty well established. And so, for example, in Yeshayah 53, where it says, you know, they have pierced my hands and feet, speaking of the form of physical death that would occur to the Passover lamb. They changed it to they gnaw at my paws, and you know that like a lion's paws they gnaw or something. I mean, just ridiculous. I mean, just absurd to get around that. And so what you find is that's the kind of stuff that they typically edit. In the 91st Psalm, you are particularly at the end, you're confronted by an entirely different set of circumstances. And there you've got to realize that there are some texts that the Masoretes did not mess with, and that the Essenes, who were the scribes for the Dead Sea Scrolls, that they had their issues, and that the Essenes claimed the 91st Psalm as defending the righteous one, the righteous teacher, which was, this goes back to the Essenes' arguments with the Pharisees and the Sadducees, goes back to the Maccabeans and to the time where there was a transition between the Louis, the Levites, being the priest to serve as those who officiate and unite at the Moed Mikre, as designated by Yahweh, being born into it without rights to property and that sort of thing. And those who wanted the job for the power and money and influence it would provide them, but that were not Louis. And so there was this fight between them for the control of what was emerging as a Jewish religion in the 2nd and 3rd century BCE. And the Essenes had this affinity for their leader, who they thought was the rightful heir to be the chief priest, and he was vested by others who thought that it shouldn't be inherited as a birthright according to the Torah, but taken based upon who is the most qualified. Let's use that term. And so that's where they hearken. And so they had less power, less influence. They were ostracized from the mainstream of the Sanhedrin by the Sadducees, who were the liberal political types, and the Pharisees, who were the fundamentalist religious wackos. The Essenes were ostracized, and that's why they were down there in Qumran, in their little hovel down there in Qumran. Right. And so when you read something that they would have claimed for themselves, then you would expect them to edit it in such a way as it would resonate with them. And I think that because they were, their savior was the righteous teacher, and the righteous teacher is not Yahweh, it's not Yahusha. The righteous teacher is a religious hack that they thought had more rights to the position of power than the Maccabees' rival individual, and so. Anything they can do to esteem that individual and to distance the passage from Yahweh, they'll do. And so that's what I see as why the difference in the Essene version of Psalm 91 is quite different than the Masoretic and the Septuagint. And in this case, the Masoretic and the Septuagint agree in opposition to the Essene version.
I tell you, it takes some work, don't it?
It does. Yeah, it does. You know, my proclivity is that I recognize there's no such thing as a perfect human. Scott's pretty close, but besides
Scott.
Scott. But you know, it's there aren't a lot of perfect humans out there. And as a result,
I got to meet this guy.
Yeah, that's right.
The name you're talking about.
Oh, okay.
your name.
You know, I spent a lot of time, you probably know, I spend most of my time now translating and commenting on Yahweh's testimony. And what I find is that I make a lot of typos. And most of my typos are just, you know, I'm think I'm writing or and I write of, you know, just because the fingers are flying across the keyboard. And, you know, and I have spell check, and I've got the ability to, you know, highlight it when it's wrong, and I still make mistakes. Now, what about these guys that are writing on an animal skin with a bird feather using dyes they got from squished clams? No erasers, no spell check. No, copy and paste. I mean, they're going to make a few mistakes. So we should not expect the Dead Sea Scrolls to be perfect. They're just old. They're 1,200 years to 1,400 years older than the oldest Masoretic. And they are written in Yisrael as opposed to written in Babylon, where the Masoretic was first scribed. So there are. It's usually more accurate, but that does not mean it's perfect.
Yeah.
Now the problem here. I mean, I want to be careful here. In the Greek, the problem apart from one situation is irreconcilable. And when it comes to the eyewitness accounts, which is really all I care about, so long as Yosha is citing or paraphrasing the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, you can get a pretty darn accurate understanding of what he said. But it takes some time because you've got to look, okay, this is what he's quoting. How is it written in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms in Hebrew? And then you can undo the damage that Greek has done to the statement. Now, with the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, the copyists were a lot less free. And so on average, between the Masoretic and the Dead Sea Scrolls, one word in 14 is different versus, of course, the difference between the 69 first, second, and third century manuscripts, the codexes of the Christian New Testament, and the Nestle Allen and the Textus Receptus. In that case, there are 300,000 known variants and 182,000 words. You know, that's more than one for one versus one in 14. So there was a lot more diligence. So it's not nearly as flawed. And the other thing that's beneficial is that the Torah, prophets, and Psalms are one cohesive whole. Same author, same purpose, same message. So everything that God has to say about who he is, what he's offering, what he expects in return, and what will get you in harmony with him and what will get you separated from him, whether it's shalom or azab, he says from hundreds of different perspectives, so many times that after a while you come to say, this is who he is, this is what he's offering, this is what he expects, and if there's a conflict in one word in 14, you just simply resolve the word so that it's consistent with the other 100 times he said the same thing.
Fair enough.
So I just don't see it as a problem in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. It's too easy to resolve. Because God's consistent. The message is consistent. He says the same thing over and over again from different perspectives, because that's how we learn. And that is how you eliminate the flaws of man.
Yeah, so as long as you know that this is, umpteen times he said this, that's got to be a mistranslation. It's the same word, right?
If he's told us 100 times that he wants us to respect and revere him as a father, and then you read that someplace that he wants us to fear him,
yeah,
then you would have to recognize
we had a real problem.
If the most important description that can be applied to a person by Yahweh is the description that Yahweh applied to David, to say that he was Tzedak. Tzedak means upright. That's what it means. It means right and it means upright. And you read that someone has endeared themselves to God because they have bowed down, which is the antithesis of being upright, then you would know that that's not right. Something is wrong there. Now, I've never encountered one, but should you encounter one, you would know that's not right. Somebody has mistranslated that. I will tell you, here's a great example. I'm translating what I think is by far the most difficult book to translate, by far and away. It's Yahshua Isaiah. And it's by far the hardest because the vocabulary is unique to it. The vocabulary You know, the Torah, it's God says the same thing over and over again using the same words. You know, you come to know 250 to 500 words, and you've got the Torah licked, man. It's not hard to understand. It's very easy to translate, fast to translate, easy to understand. Well, there are so many interesting shades of these words and so many different words to convey nuances of the same concept in Hebrew. By the time you get to Yeshayah, which is the most interesting of the prophets, because, first of all, Yeshayah commenced his revelation exactly 700 years from the time that the Torah was revealed.
Isn't that interesting?
And he wrote, "A child is born, a son is born, a son is given to us," exactly 777 years before that promise was fulfilled. And so you're dealing with something that is just really extraordinary in its timing, and the intellect that went into conveying it was way beyond anything that I have yet experienced. You know, Dode, for example, Dode is brilliant, but the tools Dode wields to communicate are consistent. You know, like a good songwriter, I'm going to take the words people understand, I'm going to use those words in all the right ways to reemphasize a theme. That's not true in Yeshayah. And so, you know, one place that it took the word rib, which is to quarrel, to contend with. And then the next is Aman, an Amanah, which is translated widow. And so the last instruction is to rib, quarrel, and contend with the widow. Now, come on. God doesn't want us to contend and quarrel with widows.
No.
And so everybody changes the definition in their English translation of rib to plead. As in, you're pleading a case for the widow. But you can't do that because rib only means plead in the sense of pleading an argument in opposition to the widow. And so then you'd have to say, all right, since rib is a very common term and it's used all over the place, R-Y-B, and it clearly means to, in fact, it means to mock, to insult, to taunt, to ridicule. To use your words to be extremely hostile to. That's what rib means.
Mm-hmm.
So what would God want us to be hostile to? Well, you realize that if I say amana, well, what part of that word would you immediately say, well, all that does is make the first letters, what it's conveying, feminine?
Mm-hmm.
The ah at the end, right?
Yeah.
So all I've got really is if I take the ah at the end and realize, all right, we're giving this a feminine spin from a feminine perspective, and he's about ready to introduce the whore of Babylon. Now all I have to do is translate Amon. And son of a gun. Amon is those who have chosen to be bound. Well, religion from ligon in the Latin means to be bound.
Mm-hmm.
Those who have been silenced, those who are dumb, those who are in league within a congregation engaged in worship. So contend with, mock, ridicule, religion.
Yeah. Mock religion.
Yeah. What the whore of Babylon is all about. And so, yeah, it's, you know, you to be able to correctly and consistently convey what God is saying, you do have to invest a fair amount of time. And I mean, there is, in the case of Amon, for example, there is nothing with Amon that is positive. It's all negative. And so Amana would be the feminization of this negative. Just as the whore of Babylon is the symbol of Satan influencing the religion, which is viewed as a feminine concept.
Well, you Queen of Heaven, on and on and on and on.
Yeah, Mother of God.
Mother God.
Yes. You know, the church is always a she.
She.
Yeah.
Mother Church.
The Mother Church.